This is the Education Gadfly Show.
All right, enough jib jam. Yep, yep. It's time for us to go on to Research Minute.
What the hell was that?
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli, of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, a man running for House Minority Leader, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mike.
I mean, why not put your name in the ring, Rick?
I don't know. Nancy needs to be challenged, I think.
I love it. I love it. So we were saying earlier, you were a little bit fired up about President Obama's appearance on 60 Minutes and some of his post-election comments.
His post-election press. Did you see his post-election press conference?
I did not see it. I read about it.
I got to say, you rarely see a president stand up and tell the American people that he thinks they're a bunch of blundering idiots who can't actually judge policy and don't much care about it, but will take whatever you give them so long as unemployment's down around 5%.
Look, and you know, we've seen this from – he's not the only one saying this. I mean, I read the Hendrik Hertzberg in The New Yorker the other day. I mean, same kind of argument. And you know, the rebuttal is saying, hey, are you saying that if the unemployment was down to 5%, they would just go along with all your policies?
That's exactly what he was saying. Yeah. And what's most interesting, though, is back in 08 – you know, he famously told the Republican caucus, hey, elections have consequences. The people spoke it. So the only thing I wonder about is, didn't Obama realize back in 08 that that these contemptible, clueless American people weren't really judging policies? They were just lashing out at the Bush economy? So why the heck did he actually think he had a mandate to move forward on health care?
I mean, the problem is, none of these elections, we think, have been much about a mandate about anything, except that people are frustrated with government and feel like it's locked up, and it is largely locked up.
But I mean, Obama explicitly said, he explicitly said that the polling would look differently, you know, people would have voted differently if unemployment was lower. I mean, suggesting they don't actually know or care about policies.
Right.
It's just interesting to hear a president say that.
Do you think he's wrong?
Yeah. Yeah, I think people actually, you know, have an intuitive sense that they want government to do more of this or less of that. Mm. And I think that absolutely factored into the election.
Look, I think, let's face it, most people are somewhat in the middle and they want policies that are centrist. And neither party has any interest in serving that up right now.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a challenge. But we got weighty right away, but we have not yet talked about education. And that we will do here on the Education Gadfly Show. We're going to play Pardon the Gadfly. We're going to hear Amber's Research Minute. We're going to hear what's up with that. So, Daniela, get us started with Pardon the Gadfly.
Maryland Legislative Committee just vetoed a state Board of Education regulation that would have made half of teachers' evaluation based on student learning, a regulation that was key to Maryland winning Race to the Top funding. On the state level, is this a sign of things to come? And on the federal level, think Arne Duncan will take back the money?
Whoops.
Oops. Didn't see this one coming, huh?
Shocking. Shocking. Let's see. Create a contest where you reward states for having consultants come in, work with your SEA to create huge sprawling documents filled with promises of stuff you might do if you can, and then it doesn't come through.
Oh no, but the State Board of Education in Maryland passed those reforms, Rick.
Oh, gee, that's right. Which means clearly they were actually in effect, except that it turns out there's this thing called the state legislature.
Right. That, it turns out, has the authority.
Of course, this is also the same secretary who promised a $1 billion bonus to Congress if they did the ESEA blueprint. So I'm not sure. Actually, no, I guess the president did. I'm not sure how strong a grasp the president and the secretary have on the finer points of American constitutional order.
Now, to their credit, the administration's spokesperson, Justin Pope, said something to the effect of, hey, you know, we're going to be strong here, and if people back off their promises, you know, we're going to be looking closely at this on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, I can't wait to see how this is, you know, you can't imagine how that's going to start getting ugly, especially if the Hill starts going into investigative hearings. But B, all right, I want to see how many million are getting clawed back from Maryland by the end of the week.
Yeah, and look, I say fine. Give the money take the money from Maryland, give it to New Jersey, who is next in line. I'm pretty sure that the governor in New Jersey is more than willing to follow through on any promises that he might have made.
I want to see these guys say, all right, we're going to do this incremental case-by-case judgment. So I want to see them tell us what percent of the Maryland promise just got unwound, and I want to see them go and demand their payback.
Hey, a little memory here. Once upon a time, there was a thing called the Bush administration, which had tried to use strong oversight over reading first. For example, when states promised to use scientifically based reading and then went off and used whole language instead. And we did something about it. guess what? That did not end well in Congress.
But the Bush administration also tried, of course, its famous NCLB implementation strategy, in which it was going to claw back dollars from states that didn't live up to their compliance plans.
That doesn't work so well.
Whoops.
All right, topic number two.
A lot of whoopses there. Topic number two. Online credit recovery programs are proliferating. Are they an innovative way to get kids across the high school finish line? Or just a sly lowering of standards to boost the graduation rate?
Yes and yes.
So, look, Rick, I'm baffled by this whole credit recovery concept here. All right, so is this basically, we have this idea that there are some kids who, you know, have failed a bunch of courses, but maybe towards the very end, they finally hit some moment of awakening where they say, oh, I really want to do well and I want to graduate, or I want to go play football in the NCAA. And so we want to give them a way to get these credits back. But isn't that, I mean, how is that not lowering standards?
You know, if you read the book The Blind Side, or saw the movie, but if you remember the book Blind Side, there's this question that Michael Orr didn't have the grades to get into, I guess it was Ole Miss, that he was wound up going to. So one of the interesting parts in the book, which gets left out of the movie, is they find an online credit recovery program where if you start taking the courses, he was punching out a course every couple days, and they would substitute that grade for the grade you earned in high school.
Right.
So I think he did about 13 of these, got his grades up to qualifying minimum, was eligible to play as a freshman. Exactly how this is consistent with the notion of we're going to elevate our expectations is totally beyond me.
Yeah. And yet, you know, there's a lot of reformers excited about this. I mean, people like Joel Klein and Michelle Rhee have been pushing this, and they have expanded their online recovery. I mean, and I think this is an area where Diane Ravitch has been raising a lot of questions, rightfully, to say, hey, this certainly seems like an easy way for districts to get their grad rates up and to pass kids who actually didn't meet the standards.
Now, I mean, there is an open question, right? If you just shuffle kids through these online credit recovery programs and they graduate, is that actually better for them than if they don't get the diploma? And that's kind of a cool and unanswered question at this point.
Mm-hmm. All right. So you don't think there's anything to the fact that we say, hey, look, the whole model of Carnegie units is all based on seat time. This is a new model of saying, hey, if kids can demonstrate that they know the material, then we're going to give them credit for what they know.
But it's not really, right? Because the assumptions, as best I understand, you know, I'm not no expert in this, but if you look at online credit recovery, I see very little effort to define clear and expansive learning objectives. Instead, they've basically taken kind of the standards from the old Carnegie model.
Mm-hmm.
Couple things, kids complete some assignments, do what have you, and boom, you process them out the door. So if you're actually talking about setting up online learning expectations that are clear and specific, then I think you're going to do a different ballgame.
All right, topic number three.
A new Harvard and Education Next study shows that 30 countries have a greater proportion of kids scoring at an advanced level than the U.S. does. Is this another sign of America's decline?
Look, it's a pretty creative study. This is out by Paul Peterson and Eric Hanishek and Ludger Wussmann. Is that how you say it?
Ludger
Wussmann?
Wussmann.
Okay, very nice. And it was good. You know, they basically looked at the NAEP advanced level, and they've equated that on the PISA scale. And so they figured out what percentage of kids in each country would hit that same mark as the U.S. And not surprisingly, most of these advanced countries do way better than we do. I mean, what's the takeaway? I mean, should we be surprised by this, that our top students aren't doing very well compared to other countries' top students?
There's all these concerns raised about the PISA. We don't need to get into them here. You know, it says for all our attention the last decade to closing the achievement gaps, that if you take the stuff at face value, that we're not doing that great at the upper ends either. And we've been spending little time or energy focusing on, high achievers the last decade.
Right. And even if you look just at white kids, if you look just at kids with college-educated parents, the story is a little better, but not much better. I mean, there's still plenty of countries. But here's a big caveat, Rick, is that the countries that do better than us still are on the whole, tiny countries and very small countries. And so I did some calculations, and I'll get this up on the blog in a few days, is, you know, that if you actually look at raw numbers, the United States still has more kids scoring at the advanced level than any other country in the PISA study because we're so big. And so even though we don't do well in proportions, our size is still helping us.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, part of that is that it's easier to run. Small countries tend to have a lot of advantages when it comes to almost anything. If you're small, if you are more homogenous, you know, people talk a lot about Singapore and Finland. But, you know, these countries educate fewer kids than a mid-sized state. So, you know, it just makes it a much easier project. Look, end of the day, this just points to the fact that we've talked ad nauseum about the achievement gap. and just kind of assume that our suburban schools are fine. But it's like the way we used to talk about college education 10, 15 years ago. We just kind of asserted that American higher ed was the best in the world. We've since changed our minds. Mm-hmm. I've yet to see much evidence that our suburban schools are really all they're cracked up to be, mm-hmm. and that they're not just leaning on the caliber of students they got coming in the door.
Yep. You can call this the gifted gap, as I did today.
Whoa.
On Twitter. How is that, huh? Joe, pretty good. Yep.
Very good.
By the way, at Michael Petrilli, that's my Twitter handle.
How do you go about getting your Twitter followers?
Well, as far as I understand it, I mean, you start by following other people, and then a lot of them will return the favor, and they'll follow you. And then the great thing is if somebody retweets something to all of their followers, and they've got a lot of them, then those people say, oh, I might just start to follow this person.
You know what I heard
today? So, for example, Diane Ravitch retweeted something for me today. I think she's got lots of followers, so, you know, we'll see. Maybe that'll
You know what I heard from one of your staff?
What's that?
That people take a shortcut to getting their Twitter followers.
I heard this, too, that people can buy their Twitter followers.
They're buying them wholesale.
That's ridiculous.
Isn't that nuts?
It's Although this might be something I might look into.
You know what? You know what it would make you?
What's that?
A Twitter cheater.
A Twitter cheater. Boom. All right. Enough jib jam. Yap yap. It's time for us to go on to Research Minute. Welcome back to the show, Amber, for everyone's favorite Research Minute.
How you doing? Nice to be here.
So, Winkler, what do you got?
All right, we're going to jump right into it. We're running long. So this week, we have a new report out from the Brookings Institution by Alan. You guys help me with this. Berube? How do you pronounce his last name? Berube?
Sure. Alan Berube.
All right, Alan Berube.
I'm pretty sure.
We're going with Berube, called the State of Metropolitan America, that examines a variety of recent census data for the nation's 100 largest metro areas, including data on educational attainment, which is where we're going to talk about what we're going to talk about today.
Oh, hold up. I got to get my popcorn. This sounds fun.
This is interesting. Number one, Americans are growing more educated, but progress appears to be slowing among younger adults. So in other words, we used to have more 24 to 34-year-olds getting college degrees than we do now, which is a reversal of the pattern from 2000. So it could be a sign that our younger generation is not making the same level of educational attainment as older generations. That's interesting. Thank you very much. Number two, more young people are going to college. 91 of 100 metro areas experienced a significant increase in the share of young adults enrolled in higher education between 2000 and 2008. Understandably, gains were especially rapid in older industrial areas such as Detroit, Cleveland, and St. Louis. Number three, smart metro areas are getting even smarter, even faster. So already highly educated, that's a new word, areas such as Boston, New York, and San Diego are among the top gainers of college grads in the 2000s. Matter of fact, and we all know this, D.C., which is the most educated metro area, beat Bakersfield, California, which is the least educated, by how many points? 34 percentage points. Finally.
Yes, DC.
Yes, finally.
Go DC, baby.
This is the most intuitive finding of them all. And our last one, workers with less than a high school diploma were likelier to keep their jobs during the recession if they lived in a handful of metro areas with high concentration of employees with college degrees. Sort of like a trickle-down effect. So all in all, a lot of interesting data. And basically, the bottom line is if you have an education, you're pretty much immune to some extent to a recession.
My Lord, I was right. That was boring.
It was not boring.
Was
there was some stuff
that
in
was
there that was interesting.
I would have eaten my popcorn, but I fell asleep before you were too far
right,
into it.
The problem with you is that you don't appreciate sociology, good sociology. Come on, this is interesting
and
stuff.
And last week, you didn't like the pension study. I mean, what is with you two this week?
Study.
That's what I'm saying.
You didn't. I liked the study, by the way. I just thought that you could have, you know, jazzed it up a little bit.
Yeah, because pension's exciting, right, Rick?
It's a big issue. Hey, this is, look, I mean, first of all, we know this, right, that well-educated people are clustering in a handful of cities, right? And there's big questions about what happens in the other parts of the country. We in Ohio, we see this brain drain, for example, and you know, kids graduate from these very good colleges in Ohio, and then they skedaddle to places like D.C. or to New York and other places. And the question is, you know, what is this going to mean for our society? I mean, for one thing, what it's going to mean is that the heartland is going to continue to hate D.C. because they're going to think that we're all a bunch of condescending jerks, which is
well, certainly Obama's press conference didn't help on that front.
True.
He's from Chicago.
Yeah, but he's in D.C.
Well, he did cluster in D.C.
And he is as president telling people that they're clueless.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I mean, if this generation's getting dumber than previous generations, you know, that's kind of a concern. I mean, frankly.
So there.
Hold on. Where remind me where Barubi said they're getting dumber.
Well, we have less college educated. It's a chance that we may have less college educated, generation than the last generation.
So this is not good for Obama's goal of getting more, you know, beating the rest of the world in terms of college graduation. All right. So but what's happening? People are going to college just as much. What are the college graduation rates declining?
Right. A quarter say they've had some college, but basically never graduated.
Hmm. Wow. This is all pretty bleak.
Pretty bleak.
All right. What depressing song do you have for us today that might go with
this? Since having a degree helps one to take care of business, this is a little stretch. We've got Taking Care of Business by Bachman Turner Overdrive.
ETO.
And I've been taking care of business every day. Taking care of business.
Rick, is it just me, or do I mostly know that song because of TV commercials?
Probably.
I guess that's the case with most classic rock these days.
I know it because of Amber. Often when you stroll into Amber's office,
She's
got TCB blaring, baby.
Taking care of business.
She's actually got those big carved kind of fake gold letters hanging over her desk.
Well, Amber's definitely.
Oh, wait a minute. That's TCBY, isn't it?
Amber must be a classic rock kind of girl, right? Or more of a country girl?
Billy Idol was my favorite.
Well, that's all the time we have for that blabber. Let's go on to everyone's new favorite segment, What's Up With That?
I woke up this morning and I got out of bed. Had a big old cup of coffee to clear my head. Telephone rang and you wanna chat? Well, sit on down and tell me what up with that? What up with that?
Chris, welcome back to the show.
Mike, Rick, how's it going?
Good.
What's up with that, Chris?
I like this What's Up segment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty good.
I haven't been excited about the final segment since like the halcyon days of Jeff Kooner throwing out his pink slips.
Oh boy, listeners, anybody with us back in those days? Those were good ones. Although we did lose many visitors back, many listeners back then. I mean, really, we got notes from people saying, I always like listening to you guys, you're so reasonable, but that Jeff Kooner guy, he's crazy. There's a little bit of Fox News in the middle of the Education Gadfly Show. All right, Chris, what you got for us today?
All right, well, I'll try to stay away from that then, I guess. But no, as time draws closer, it's getting to be about time for high school students to begin preparing for their college entrance exams. One 14-year-old claims to have found the secret to achieving a better score on the SAT. After taking the SAT for the second time, Milo Beckman was able to improve his score on the essay section and is attributing the improvement solely to one factor. Using a more sophisticated vocabulary, you might guess? Writing with better structure? Nope. Beckman says besides being overall inferior, the only thing different about his second essay was that it was significantly longer.
This is the key to Rick Hess's success all these years. He just writes more words than anybody else.
In fact, going into the second exam, Milo asked his friends to take note of how many lines they had written on their essays as well. Out of 115 samples, longer essays almost always earned higher scores. He's not alone in his belief. MIT professor Les Perlman, director of writing across curriculum, previously reported the same positive correlation between word count and essay score. Naturally, the College Board disagrees with the finding, claiming that oftentimes longer writing samples typically convey more effective, persuasive arguments. Milo tried to take into account by comparing the scores of students who have taken the SAT more than once. Every single one of the students in his informal study got a higher score on their longer essay. We're all aware that standardized college entrance exams have long been a hot topic of debate regarding their implications and validity. The idea that graders of the SAT essay section are geared more towards quantity than quality helps the argument of standardized test advocates about as much as Nixon helped bring transparency to the White House. Milo's second essay cited facts that turned out to be blatant lies, yet was still regarded by the College Board as better prose than his first attempt. Can the SAT essay section truly be the most predictive of college success out of all the sections of the test, as deemed by the College Board, when something as simple as word count has such a drastic impact on score? What's up with that?
Actually, I find the correlation with college performance easy to believe, because most faculty are more than happy to grade on length.
Yes, that's right.
Which is actually why when we hire people who come out of colleges, it takes a couple years to teach them to stop trying to pad every god-awful word they can into a sentence or a paragraph.
Right, right, right.
Colleges destroy people's ability to write if they showed up with any ability to begin with.
Hey, I got to tell you, you know, word up to Milo. Is that his name, Milo?
Yes, Milo.
Yeah. I mean, this is pretty good.
This is
killer. For, you know, to go out there and try to figure this out, crack the code. I like it. Mm-hmm. I hope he finds a way to make some money off of this. Maybe he'll have a special SAT prep little, you know, website that people can go to.
It's but there's not a lot of secret to it. It's just kind of write more.
Write more, yeah.
Well, Professor Perlman, actually, from MIT, has his own advice section, which includes things such as is including quotes on your if you quote someone, regardless of whether it's related to the topic or not.
Mm. Or whether the quote is actually correct.
Yes, and to always act like you know what you're talking about, because they don't call you when you make stuff up, as Milo noted himself.
Well, we know that. I mean, that's like my first rule of punditry right there. What? Sure, you want me to ask me a question about the impact of la-di-da-di, la-di-da?
You know what they usually call this? They call it fake it till you make it.
Till you make it. You know what this reminded me of? The other day, I had to do this Fox News thing, and I'm sitting there waiting and blah, 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 and there were some other interviews going on. They had a guy on who they had has written a book about how to win the lottery and has claimed that he has these surefire ways to increase your chances of winning the lottery.
For instance?
So, for instance, you know, figure out if they've already given away the grand prize in a game, like, don't play that game. So that's something. But also, like, always play the same number. Don't keep switching your numbers.
Why?
Now, see, I mean, I can imagine how these would have, you know, like, on the margins, like, slightly improve your odds.
No, but no, still, hold on. How the hell does it affect your odds what number you play in the lottery?
Well, I'm just saying, if you're going to play in the same game at the same time, like, I don't know. But he got on Fox News, and he has a whole book.
Mike.
About how to win the lottery. My point was, this can't be correct, right? The mathematics
Mike,
are such
I think
that
you're thinking about this all wrong. I think the fact, what you should be asking yourself is why you were taking your time to go sit in a studio to wait to be on a TV show after a guy who's telling people how to help them win the lottery.
What I want to know is why this guy can get his book published and I can't.
What's up with that?
What is up with that? Nicely said. Okay, we're all the time we got today. We're out of here. Until next week.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Education Gadfly Show. Signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.